You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Here in Wisconsin, you might be familiar with fish like muskie, walleye, perch, and bass, but how about burbot? We'll learn about its comeback story and why our guest says they deserve a lot more respect. Now, earlier this week, President Biden rolled out some details of a proposal for a big infrastructure plan. Over 8 years, the roughly $2 trillion package includes hundreds of billions of dollars for improving roads, bridges, broadband access, as well as drinking water systems and other initiatives that would address climate change. And it's got a price tag to pay for it. In part, the bill would raise the corporate tax rate and make other changes to taxes for corporations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the taxes that corporations currently pay? What do you think of the corporate tax cuts of 2017? Do you like the idea of raising the rate? Dislike it? And what do you want to know about the impact it could have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, there's a lot in this bill, and it's just a proposal at this point, really. But when you look at what it has to say about corporate tax rates and enforcement and things like that, what are you looking at? What kind of questions does it raise for you?
Well, I think that's an important aspect of this package. You know, unlike the previous packages, both the $4 trillion that was passed before the Trump administration ended and the $1.9 trillion package that was just passed, this one is in large part financed by raising taxes. And that's important when we think about both the long-term impact on debt and the impact on the economy in the short term. Estimates are, you know, the package is about $2.2 trillion in spending. Between $1.5 and $2 trillion is going to be increased revenue from changing the tax code. I think that's important. So that's saying that hopefully a good chunk of the financing is going to be through higher taxes. And that's going to be on corporations. We're taking back the corporate tax rate, which was 35%. Before 2017, which then went down to 21%, and now we're going to bring it back up to 28%. So if you're thinking, wow, you know, we're going way back into the past in terms of corporate tax rates, in some sense, no. We're sort of reversing a little bit of what happened in 2017. And in addition, we're hopefully tightening up on the ability of multinational corporations to shift around their revenues to avoid taxes. I think that's one big chunk of the program that they have in mind, is to get more tax revenue from corporations.
Menzie, I think it gets confusing sometimes when we hear, okay, corporations have this this tax rate that bounces around as bills pass Congress, but then we hear news stories that says company X, a big company you've heard of, paid little or no federal taxes in any given year. What's going on there?
Well, there are a multitude of things. I can't say I'm a tax expert, but, you know, in any whenever you file your own taxes, you know that there are different ways of categorizing income, different ways in which you can take either deductions or credits. Well, for corporations, they have a lot more flexibility in all these things to sort of allocate. Well, where are the profits being made or allocated? Is it here or is it in Ireland? You know, how much of that can you tax from the United States when you're supposed to be taking into account, you know, the fact that they're being taxed, let's say, overseas, perhaps at a lower rate. In addition, you know, you can state expenses in ways that might not make sense, you know, in some common sense way, but could eliminate your liability for a given year if you allocate your expenses in a certain way. So, you know, there, even for a corporation onshore with no multinational operations, you could, you know, there's ways to be somewhat imaginative in how you submit your tax forms. When you get into the international arena, there's a lot more leeway, and it's not as if the international tax authorities can somehow coordinate to make sure that, you know, nobody's evading or avoiding the taxes in some way.
One basic criticism of the idea of bringing corporate tax rates back up, again, as you said, not to where they were before 2017, but bringing them up, is, okay, we're just still trying to come out of this pandemic, still trying to get the economy to bounce back. Raising the taxes on corporations raises the cost of doing business for manufacturers and others. That's going to hurt the recovery. Is there something to that?
Well, you know, that's sort of a hold everything else constant analysis. So it's hard to say how big the effect is. Presumably, if you raise corporate tax rates, maybe there'll be a bit less investment. Maybe profits will be lower, so perhaps stock prices might be lower. I'd say this is particularly a time when you don't need to worry too much about at least the latter aspect. But the point of the matter is, this is not holding everything else constant. You're raising corporate tax rates in order to finance government expenditures. And in this case, really a lot of it is investment in infrastructure and other capital, where, you know, if you think about it, the government is hopefully putting funds and resources into projects that get, let's say, on average 7% return when the interest rate at which the government borrows right now for, let's say, 10 years is negative. It's below zero in real terms. So this is an opportune time for the government to devote resources to expanding productive capacity of the economy over the longer term. I mean, people talk about competitiveness all the time. Well, part of the competitiveness of the U.S. economy is how well your workforce is trained, how well your infrastructure works, you know, from the airports to the roads to the bridges to the high-speed broadband. All those things are part of the input into our ability to produce goods and services at competitive costs.
We're talking to Menzie Chin from UW-Madison, looking at the idea of increasing corporate taxes to help pay for the proposed infrastructure package from the White House. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. David is with us in New Richmond. David, hi.
Hi. Say, I wanted to bring up the point that not all corporations are huge companies that have lots of people on salary. Almost every farm you drive by is incorporated, whether it's a great big farm or a mom and pop farm. A lot of just small businesses themselves are incorporated. I'm a business owner, incorporated. Because of, you know, I consider myself a Republican because of this goofy president that we did have and the tariffs. If you look at rail, I'm in the rail business. If you look at rail car loadings are just down across the board in the last 3.5 years. And my business is down literally 90%. And to look at increasing the taxes on businesses that are struggling right now, just because they're corporations does not mean that they're great big companies like Target or something like that. That's the point that I wanted to make, that people kind of confuse that. A lot of times it's a mom and pop company that's incorporated.
So, gotcha, David. Thanks a lot for the call. Good luck in your business. Menzie, would these kind of corporate tax increases, the tax rate increase, maybe damage small businesses like David's?
Well, once again, I'm not clear on the exact details of how, you know, the tax code is replete with lots of special rates, deductions, credits, and so forth. So that, you know, we talk about, for instance, a 35% tax rate that applied to corporations before 2017. But in essence, no corporation paid effectively 35% because there were so many, you know, details in the tax code that allowed corporations to pay essentially less than 35%, substantially less. So as we move forward, you can imagine if the tax rate goes up, depending upon the details of what exemptions, deductions, credits still remain in the code, it could be that a given corporation might see an increase in its effective tax rate and another one not at all, even though they're both corporations. Depends a lot upon the particulars of the activity that they're engaged upon and how they allocate their losses and profits and so forth. One thing I will say is that a big part of the effort that the Biden administration is putting an effort into it is to manage somehow to make multinational corporations pay a greater share of their, well, burden, as at least as it perceived by the administration, that is to have them pay more in tax revenues. To the extent that the Biden administration is able to tailor the changes no changes to hit that objective of targeting multinational corporations, then small mom and pop corporations probably will not have as big a hit or impact as other corporations.
Thanks for that call. And Menzie, yeah, you mentioned Ireland earlier. There's been that that story on and off of companies doing what I think is called inversion, where they relocate some of their headquarters to a lower tax country, and that somehow, through means that I don't fully understand, gets them out of some of their taxes in the U.S. Is that the kind of thing you see maybe these Biden administration changes trying to cut down on?
I think it's an attempt to do something like that. Now, it's a complicated thing because obviously these multinational corporations have tremendous armies of accountants to help them out, lawyers and accountants, to try to figure out how to game any particular system. But the fact of the matter is the U.S. has a slightly different manner of taxing international income than other countries. And between these gaps, there are ways to work around it. So the question is, how can you reduce the ability of corporations to get around the taxes? And the imposition of things like a minimum tax rate that's based upon a number that is hard to move around by accounting means is one way of trying to get more revenue. So that is why there's besides the fact that we don't have all the details, there's a lot of uncertainty about how much tax revenue will be gained as you tighten up the restrictions on, you know, international income and so forth. It's just that it's not clear how effective we can be in capturing that income. Hope is we capture a lot.
We're talking to Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. We're looking at some possible effects of a boost in corporate taxes. That's in President Biden's proposal to help fund major infrastructure improvements. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of raising the corporate tax rate in part to help pay for infrastructure and other ways of cracking down on ways that companies avoid paying that rate? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with public affairs and economics professor Menzie Chin from UW-Madison, looking at tax policy changes proposed by the Biden administration aimed at paying for infrastructure and other domestic development, including an increase in the corporate tax rate and cracking down on ways of avoiding those taxes. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, ideas, and questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Carolyn is with us in Mauston. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. I guess I would like to make more of a comment. I've worked with a few businesses, and my experience and what I've seen is the manners in which they take write-offs, expenses, personal expenses, called business expenses, which really, if you're an honest person, wasn't. I had an experience where a foreign company owned our company in the United States, and after a one-hour meeting or two-hour meeting in February, after the tax period ended, they went from owing $80,000 in federal tax, it was like 3 years ago, to zero, and actually getting refunds back for that year and three previous years by recapturing so-called taxes that they had paid previously. So the IRS right now goes after low-hanging fruit. So they go after W-2 people, people who are 1099, and have not been funded to the ability to go after companies with complex taxes. In my case, my experience, they weren't that complex. If they do a little digging, they could have found this stuff out if they would have been audited. And it's proven, I believe, that for every dollar you put into the IRS, they make like what, $4 to $10 back. I can't remember what the stats were. And that is one aspect of this new policy. And in regards to having a minimum tax, I'm sure they'll consider mom and pop stores under a certain amount of income, sales, net profit.
Gotcha. Carolyn, thanks a lot for the call. And Menzie, I've seen that argument elsewhere that the IRS is under-resourced for pursuing the kinds of audits and things like that for the most complex cases, corporations, wealthy people who have a lot of ways of moving money around. Is that something you see needing to be solved?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's been true for years and years and years. There's been continuous opposition from certain elements to resourcing the IRS to greater degree, especially in terms of the size of the economy. So, you know, over time, as the tax code gets more and more complicated and corporations and wealthy individuals get better and better at trying to move around their assets in a way such that it's hard to tax them, then it's clear that an extra dollar that's devoted to IRS enforcement is probably going to yield many dollars more in return in higher tax revenues. So that goes without saying. In general, though, I think we need, in addition to greater enforcement, just a change to the legislation and the tax code so that there's some way that you can just capture, for instance, a multinational's profits, no matter how they allocate them on the books around the world. And so I think that's a chief objective of any reform that's coming down the line.
Carolyn, thanks for the call. We'll go to Barry next in Kenosha. Barry, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Barry?
I want to bring up the fact that corporate welfare creates jobs. One example I have, a true example, Abbott Labs, where I retired from, they were going to build a $90 million biologics pilot plant in North Chicago, Illinois. Illinois gave them a $900,000 cash incentive to build, and Ireland gave them an $85 million cash incentive. So take a wild guess where they built the plant. So we need more corporate welfare. And then that's what Europe does. Europe lures our corporations away, and they make their money back with income tax, you know?
Barry, thanks a lot for the call. Menzie, a lot of times when people use the phrase corporate welfare, it's in a derogatory sense. Barry says we need it to keep companies or lure companies to the U.S. What do you think?
Well, I think it's complicated, but the better option would be to somehow constrain governments from offering these inducements, because then it's, if you don't, then it's kind of a race to the bottom. It's a race to give each of these corporations bigger and bigger benefits so that they, locate in one place. We don't need to look to Illinois. We can look to Foxconn. Would that have been cost effective even if they had built the plant that they promised, and they're unlikely to do what they promised to. Now, that's all at the state and local level, these inducements, at least in the U.S. I think the thing that the Biden administration would like to do is to try to cooperate with international tax authorities, tax authorities in other countries, so that we don't have a race to the bottom and yet at the same time capture more of the tax revenue that they believe that they're entitled to. The question of these inducements, they're important, but I don't think directly they're going to be dealt with in the reform here.
Thanks for that call. Looking at this infrastructure package, that makes me think how effective is this kind of spending as an economic stimulus? Because, for example, a highway in Wisconsin, you can't build it in Ireland. It's got to be there. Is this a good way to use federal resources to boost the economy?
Well, actually, I say absolutely. In fact, the quintessential canonical example of government spending that most macroeconomists support right now is infrastructure spending. And the reason is, first of all, the bang for the buck is the biggest. It's like for each dollar devoted to infrastructure, estimates vary, you might get $1.5 in economic activity in return. for a given year. In addition, the impact on the economy is much more longstanding. So compared against consumption, where let's say you hire 1,000 more civil servants versus you build or you fix a bridge or you put in broadband, fiber optics and so forth, the latter is going to give you is going to lower costs of production for firms and for lower costs for households into the future. And so what's true is that of all the government spending that you can think of, okay, tax cuts or tax expenditures, government spending on employees, things like that, of the things that are going to directly impact the economy over time the most, it's going to be infrastructure spending. The one thing I'll add to this is if you were afraid of the possibility of the economy would overheat, given that we're adding on another $2.2 trillion of spending on top of the $6 trillion or so that we've done over the past couple of years, I'll just add that because this is a tax-financed spending increase, the stimulus is going to be a lot less. In addition, the tax changes are going to be spread over 15 years, whereas the spending is going to be over the next 8 years. The contrast is with the package that just passed, the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. That was going to be mostly spent out over the next 2 years. Okay, so in some sense, this is a measure that is not so much stimulus, but a measure to restore competitiveness to the U.S. economy over a longer span of time, targeting areas, both conventional infrastructure and things like home care help and so forth, and research and development that have been thought of as being underfunded.
Menzi, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Menzi Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. We talked to him about proposed tax policy changes, part of a new infrastructure package introduced this week by President Biden. Coming up, one of Wisconsin's native fish has made a big comeback. It's not a household name. Our guest says it should be. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at a new museum exhibit in Wisconsin that brings together artists from different backgrounds here in the state and beyond. Now a fish native to the Great Lakes and some of Wisconsin's inland waters is making a comeback. Burbot look kind of weird, like a mix of eel and cod. When they're caught, they tend to wrap their slimy tails, apparently, around the angler's hands and arms. That may explain why they haven't been a popular sport or commercial species around here. They even have a mating call. Check it out. If you can get over their odd appearance, they're apparently good eating. They're referred to as freshwater lobster. There's actually a 3-day burbot festival in northern Minnesota that draws more than 10,000 people every year. But here's where our next guest has a problem. Under Wisconsin state law, burbot is considered a rough fish in the same category as common carp, Asian carp, sea lampreys, and other undesirables. It also means they're unprotected. He says that's wrong and disrespectful and is calling for a change. Paul Smith is outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, good to have you back.
Good afternoon, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, tell us a little bit about the burbot. It's passed in Wisconsin. It did have kind of a heyday in Lake Michigan, and people were kind of into it as a fish, it sounds like.
You know, it's one of our native fish in Lake Michigan and Lake Superior, and it was also found in our major river systems, St. Croix, Chippewa, Wisconsin River System, and Lakes Winnebago. It was available to early settlers in this state. And here on the Lake Michigan shore, it was commercially caught in the 1800s. And there was nothing, no negative connotations about it. You know, it's a native freshwater food source, and people definitely took advantage of it. And unfortunately, it started to decline along with the native lake trout. Those two fish were actually the top predators in Lake Michigan if you went back 300 years. And when our lakes got opened up to invasive species like the sea lamprey, things started to change. And as we know now, Lake Michigan, for instance, is a very different lake than it used to be. So the sea lampreys decimated the lake trout population and burbot. So they declined. But then when sea lamprey control started taking hold in about the 1960s, burbot started to recover. And they didn't get any help from anybody, Rob. This is another reason that I really like them. The lake trout got millions and millions of dollars of federal assistance. They were raised in federal hatcheries and stocked by the millions in our lakes, but nobody lifted a finger for burbot. And they've come back, and they're doing actually pretty well, in part because, I mean, they're a great survivor. They're a predator fish. They're down there eating what they can. Now they're taking advantage of round goby, which is another invasive species, but they like the bottom. Burbot eat a lot of their food off the bottom. And so they're recovering in part because of they're taking advantage of round gobies now. And I would like to see them reclassified. I don't think burbot, which is also known as eel pout and lawyer or freshwater cod, belongs in the same grouping as those carp species you mentioned or sea lamprey.
Now, before we get into that reclassification idea, can you give us paint us a picture of what burbot looks like and how they can be distinguished from other typical sport fish?
Yeah, many people have probably never seen one, Rob. That, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So I happen to think they're a handsome fish. They've got a mottled skin, sort of a brownish olive colored skin, and they have very small scales. So they have a smooth skin. And yes, it's like an eel. They've got a fused dorsal fin, which goes all the way to the tail. So that enhances that eel-like appearance. But they've got these spots, sort of a mottled outer appearance, a very wide mouth. And they have a single barbel, like a whisker, that comes off the bottom of its chin. So maybe think of a jazz musician. And then they've got two adaptations on their pectoral fins, the little extensions that also are to be sensitive and pick up vibrations on the bottom. That's what the chin barbel is for also. They can feed in very deep, very dark water through these extra sensory perception that they have. And a wide mouth, long, slender type of fish. And if you hold one in your arm, it may try to wrap its tail around you. That's just one of its reactions. Most fish can't do that. Maybe another reason to respect them. They're normally in deep water, but in winter, so they've got a couple of distinctions. It's our only freshwater cod species in Wisconsin. There are more than a dozen in saltwater. This is our only freshwater cod, and they're our earliest spawner. So they start coming in on these spawning migrations. So they're out in, say, Lake Michigan deep water. Sometime in December, they typically start to make a migration into our river mouths. And that's where anglers like me like to try to catch them mid-December or so. And that's where you might typically see them. Some places sell it. There's a restaurant in a fish market on Washington Island up at the tip of Door County that sells lawyers. And he seems to attract good business because his sign on the outside of his business reads "Fresh Lawyers." And there's a number of people who seem to enjoy to get a chance to sink their teeth into a lawyer.
Talking to Paul Smith about the burbot, a.k.a. lawyer, and a couple different names, the forgotten fish of the Great Lakes. Paul's the outdoor editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So, Paul, this classification, they're considered a rough fish. What does that mean?
That means they're totally unprotected. People can take them by any means. They could take them with nets or spears or hook and line or with their hands. 365 days a year and in unlimited number. So they're totally unprotected. And that's just really not becoming of a beautiful native fish like this for any reason. And if they were reclassified, that would make them a game fish. And then some protections could be put on. That doesn't mean the bag limit would have to even change. But I think just out of a matter of respect, and I think it's just the proper way to manage a great native fish like this. It's out there in the ecosystem, and we should help it sustain itself.
What does it do to make that kind of, or what does it take to make that kind of change?
It's interesting in Wisconsin because we have some things in state statute that just cause you to scratch your head. Rob, this is one of them. Our state statutes includes burbot in a list of rough fish. And that, I think, to me, more properly would be left to the DNR to set in administrative code. Those are rules that they set, just like fishing rules. And they could determine what it is. But it would take a change in state law to remove the burbot from that list of rough fish.
Wait, so this actually, it's not just a DNR classification. State law actually specifies this fish is a rough fish.
It's absolutely. It is in our state statute as NR29.001-74. So, yeah, absolutely. And it's listed along with Asian carp, goldfish, sea lamprey, and alewife. And that's just wrong.
So you're hoping to bring this up at the Wisconsin Conservation Congress spring hearings later this month. Tell us about that.
I am, yes. That's our annual process. We've had it. It's one of our beautiful Wisconsin traditions where the public can weigh in on matters of a broad range of natural resources. And among other things, citizens can introduce resolutions for things they'd like to see changed. So I'm introducing a resolution to change the classification of burbot, to remove it. The first step would be to remove it from that rough fish designation in our state statute. Again, this would not, even if it gets a lot of support, wouldn't make any change, but it would serve as a gauge of public support for such a change. And then lawmakers could take it up. They would, a bill would have to be written and passed to make the change eventually.
And now, Paul, I got to ask, you have eaten burbot, is that right?
I happen to love it. It's one of its nicknames is freshwater lobster. And that's the reason you mentioned that big festival in Minnesota. People love burbot because they're aggressive fish. So they hit anglers, they fight hard, and then they're good to eat. So that hits on all cylinders if you're an angler. One of the standard recipes, and it's delicious, is to cube the meat of the burbot in, say, 1-inch cubes, get some 7-Up boiling, and then you drop these cubes into 7-Up. It sinks, and about a minute later, it floats. When it floats up, it's done. You get it out of there, and then you serve it with drawn butter with toothpicks and just have a party and eat those cubes. And with the drawn butter, it tastes exactly like lobster.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Paul Smith is the outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him about the burbot and why he says it ought to be reclassified as a game fish here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we learned about a new art exhibit in Appleton featuring a diverse group of artists from the state and beyond. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, it's 1A Plus and the weekly news roundup with the latest on the president's infrastructure plan and more. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, an artist turned curator at an art museum in Appleton are trying to change the visibility of underrepresented artists in the exhibition space. For its spring exhibition, the Trout Museum of Art chose Tiana Bowie to guest curate. She's a visual artist from Chicago and Milwaukee and holds a Master of Fine Arts degree from UW-Madison. She's also assistant professor and section chair of printmaking at the College for Creative Studies. Tiana, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about the exhibition, the title, and what you set out to do here.
Yeah, so in around like September of 2020, I was approached by Trout Museum just to realize an exhibition that would be responsive to what's going on in the climate today. And that's a really huge feat, right? And so I was like, actually, I would love to be a part of that experience. And so I was like, well, let's talk about what's going on and be transparent. And what are we looking for when we say inclusion and diversity? What does that mean? And so my first thought was marginalized, right? Who has been left out in society and who needs to have a place who needs to be on a pedestal right now, right? And so I thought about, we need to unravel structures in the world and we need to restructure them and then we need to reveal them and have that conversation. And that's where the title of the show came from. So, yeah.
Yeah, the title, Unraveled, Restructured, Revealed, Where Contemporary Art and Diverse Perspectives Intersect. So you've got your basic mission there, but you've got basically this blank canvas, in effect. How do you start to tackle this huge task?
Well, the benefit of being an artist and curating the show is that I've been on the other end of it for so long in my career that I was like, pretty much every artist is like, well, if I was curating the show, ... So for me, I was like, well, I'm getting this opportunity. Let me think about what isn't okay. If I want to be inclusive, I can't just think about people that I know. So I called people that I do know and said, send me a list of people that I don't know. And so it was like this kind of fun sitting a list through Instagram, through email, just giving me a bunch of people that I know, don't know. And then I was like, well, I definitely want to have a major group show. I thought about a show with two or three people, but I was like, no, I think let's invite and include as many people as possible. And I was like, we have the space, right? And they were like, I think so. So I was like, okay. And I started out in my head thinking that I was going to invite 100 artists. And then it actually, I ended up inviting 85 artists and 61 responded. And I thought that was really beautiful odds and excellent that I'm like, I got that many people, because I was like, well, we could ask for 100 and get zero. Right. So, and it was also, it's like in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of all this stuff, is it appropriate? And a lot of artists were like, I've been wanting to show at a museum. I've been waiting for this opportunity. And if now's not a good time, then when is? So that was a really, my response was overwhelming and exciting. So I was able to get to 61 and I was like, well, that's great. And I was at the last minute. I was still asking people to be a part of the show, by the way. Like, I was like, oh, I forgot about this artist. I see him on Instagram. Do you want to be be a part of this show? And they're like, yeah. So I kept going and I finally had to tell myself to stop.
Can you give us some of the flavor here and tell us about a couple of the artists, not all 61 probably, but let us know a couple of the people and what we'll see there.
Well, I think the beauty of this show is if I had to retitle it, it'll be 61 of my favorite artists, right? Because I was like that. The hard thing was asking is like, pick a favorite. I'm like, they're all literally my favorite. I can't, but I will say things that stand out, that stand out in the sense of like, okay, people are surprised. I did go to the Trap Museum and was there people didn't know I was a curator. So it was funny to like listen to people in their response. But I think like Patrick Kwan, because his work is coming from, he's a Ghanaian artist. And so people are like, wow, I never really got to see an African artist work on display in Appleton, Wisconsin, really. And so that conversation of place and identity, and then it's here in this place, in Wisconsin. So that was kind of fun to witness people respond. And let's see, I think about like, okay, so then there's the other cool thing is there's mom and son. So Frida High and her two sons are in the show. And that's pretty great when you have different generations. And Sabrina Nelson and her son, Mario Moore, and you're like, oh wait, these artists came from someone who also was an artist. And when do they get the half shows at the same time? And this was their first time showing with their kids and with their mom, which I thought was pretty impressive and pretty and awesome. And why don't you get asked to show with your kids if you're all contemporary artists?
We're talking to Tiana Bowie. She is the curator. She's an artist herself and the curator of an exhibit at the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton. It's called Unraveled, Restructured, Revealed, where contemporary art and diverse perspectives intersect. And you've touched on this a little bit already, Tiana. Can you talk about the groups that are underrepresented in the art museums we might be familiar with and why it's important to highlight them?
Yeah, I think I immediately was thinking about the LGBTQ community, Latinx, anyone from the African diaspora, individuals who are dealing with immobility and visible and invisible disabilities, and what does that look like? And so when we were putting this show together, I had to think, you know, somebody asked me, was it hard to think of all the people? I said, no, not for me, because I have all these people in my life. It's like when your friends are diverse, it makes it easy. And of course, you're going to always be leaving somebody out or something out. So that's why I called on other people to say, what am I missing? You know. And so that was the fun challenge. But if having to include when you're in your own world all the time, you do have to stop and consider, who have I not thought about? And I think that was also pretty a fun experience, but a learning experience as well.
As you mentioned, this all happened during a pandemic. What kind of things did you do to make it accessible, even if people aren't willing to go in and see? What kind of things can we do online if we don't make it to the museum itself?
Yes, I one of my first things was like, we have to make this a virtual exhibit, and not a virtual one where it's like the work is just static and it's sitting. I'm like, no, let's actually like let people as if they're walking through the actual museum. So we hired a guy named Josh Hintz who did an amazing job. And I told him, he's like, I was like, you're like the new consultant for virtual exhibitions in Wisconsin. He's been doing a lot of spaces and he had a really good time. He's like, this was by far my biggest space that I had to incorporate. So you can see there's on the URR Unravel Restructure Reveal website, there's a, and also through the Trop Museum website, there's a link. So you can click there and actually check out each floor. There's three floors. There's over 150 pieces of artwork. and so you can't be bored, which is exciting.
Yeah, that is a lot. And does this make you, I don't know, think about how to exhibit art in the future, maybe in the hopefully near-term future, even when there's not a pandemic? Do you want to have, do you think that should be a part of an art show, even if it doesn't need to be?
Absolutely. It's just like Zoom. Like, Zoom's going nowhere. Now school, like, I'm a you know, college professor, and now we're thinking about courses should be accessible and online. Whether your school was a part of that or not, it's like, that's the thing. Like, what can we take from this moment that we could take with us and continue to think about visibility and accessibility? So for me, I'm like, absolutely, the virtual aspect is here to stay, and I'm excited about it. And speaking of like technology, I think another artist in the show, Noor Ballout, she has a piece, or they have a piece where there's an OnlyFans connection. So I love this idea of implementing technology with art. And all right, you want to see this piece? You have to subscribe to my OnlyFans. That's so smart. And so I love that connection.
So looking at this, people could see this still for another couple months. It's up to May 23rd. We've got a link at wpr.org/centraltime. Do you hope that this makes museums rethink the way they do their own exhibits in the future and who the communities they're reaching out to, both to have their art there and to invite in to see it?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we're all learning, right? There's no, the great thing is there is no one answer and you have to do it exactly this way, because where we're located is different from the next location. So it's really good to see what other museums are doing. What are the new best practices, right? Okay, well, let me take a piece of what that museum is doing. And does it fit our structure where we are? And the other way that we're going to be doing things is making sure that the artists get to speak. There are 61 artists. So of course, we don't, you know, how do you do that? So I'm actually doing Zoom conversations with the artists coming up. So that's going to be up and out there before the show comes down.
Now, again, you're an artist yourself going through this experience. Does this give you a taste for curating now? Do you want to do more things like this?
I'm open to it, but I will tell you one thing. It definitely gives me a taste for administration on the other side of the museum space. I think we think museums and we immediately think money. Oh, there's a lot of money and resources. And you go, actually, that's something we would museums would love to have unlimited budgets. And so I got to see it from the practical side of white. There's a budget, there's a cutoff. And we have to be strategic about that because there's so much more planning. And this one show isn't the only show. So how do you be strategic? So I learned a lot. And Trop Museum is so, the staff, the director, everybody's so awesome. And we all learned from each other. So it was a great experience.
We'll leave it there. Tiana, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Tiana Bowie is the guest curator for Appleton's Trout Museum of Art Spring Exhibition. We've been talking about her goals to showcase underrepresented artists. The exhibition is called Unraveled, Restructured, Revealed, where contemporary art and diverse perspectives intersect. The exhibition is running now. It lasts through May 23rd. As I mentioned, you can find a link with more info up on our website. It's at wpr.org/centraltime. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show, Monday at 7. It's the State Capitol Report. A state lawmaker makes the case for more micro-schooling options, a step between homeschooling and what we might think of as full-on schools. Plus, we'll get a response to a state Supreme Court ruling that overturns Wisconsin's mask mandate. That's Monday at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a science journalist shares some practical advice for deciding what COVID risks your household can take and which ones you maybe want to stay away from for now. And by the way, we had a Food Friday conversation, a fun one about Hmong cuisine with a chef originally from Wisconsin, now with a restaurant in the Twin Cities. We've got a link to some great recipes that maybe you'll want to try over the weekend. You could find a link. We talked about three of them. You get six when you go here. Find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Again, that's WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.